Hey everyone, my name is Reeves, and I want to tell you about my Proud Pride moment. And it's interesting because I got a notification in one of my groups that talked about, oh, share your pride moment that you can share with someone. And for whatever reason that popped into my head, I realized that I didn't mention a very significant part of my life experience. And that was my time serving as a board member on the board of directors for the Miracle of Love Incorporated. Now, for those of you who, you know, haven't had a chance to look at my history and so forth, let me kind of share this with you. So I became an attorney in 2001. And for those of you who are not familiar with the legal community, one of the things that if you're working in a legal firm, well, it doesn't matter what size it's in, there is this interest in generating cases, what we call rainmaking. So one of the things that a lot of young associates do is that you're trying to figure out ways to demonstrate your value to your law firm. And so by doing so, one of the ways you do so is demonstrate it through generating cases for your firm. So I was working for a plaintiff's firm, working in a particular area, and I was trying to find organizations that I could be affiliated with or participate in that would open doors for me to possibly generate revenue in terms of potential clients. So fast forward about 5 years in, it's about 2006, and one of my friends from law school is actually a human resource director for this small nonprofit, small in terms of just the number of people, because I think they were less than 50, if I remember correctly at the time, and generated a couple million dollars revenue and so forth. It was an organization, it was a 501c3 federally nonprofit HIV AIDS service organization that provided services to the LGBTQ community with an emphasis towards African American and Hispanic American men. So I'm like, okay, so she gives me a buzz, interestingly enough. And she's like, hey, got this opportunity for you. Would you like to participate? And so I'm like, okay, what's going on? She was like, I know that you're, you know, here's the situation. I know that you're looking for organizations to be a board member of. She knows my wife, and she knows that we both have kind of this family history with regards to having people in our families who are part of this community. So she thought that this might be a good fit for me. So I'm like, cool, not a problem. Now, let me tell you, when I joined the board, I'd been on a couple of boards, but some of the boards I'd been on before were larger boards where really I was just kind of a regular rank and file member where I didn't have to do anything except come there, read a few papers, vote on some stuff and keep going. And I can tell you, and this is not trying to be crass, that in most of those instances, I had an interest in the organization, but I wasn't like gung-ho all the way in and so forth like that. I had knowledge of how the organizations worked and so forth, but just not full-throated in terms of how I was doing everything. Well, I can tell you, for this organization, she made it very clear. She said, this is a small organization, this is an active board, so you're going to get to work. So I'm like, okay. So it was fascinating because I came on board. I was the only attorney on the board. Most of the other people on the board were community activists, or it was a nice mixture of community activists as well as some retirees, as well as a couple of the actual users, meaning people who actually the community that they served, meaning we had individuals who benefited from the services of the organization. And the next thing I know, I've been there for a little bit, and probably within the first 5 to 6 months, we realized we need a board secretary. We need a board secretary. They asked me to volunteer. And so I said, sure, I'll do it. So I became board secretary. And I'm going to just kind of not take you through every day and moment. I joined the organization in 2006. I think I became board secretary probably the beginning of 2007. I didn't stop being a member of the organization until I relocated to a different state in 2017. That's right. I basically served on the board for a decade. And by the time I left the board, I was the longest board member I think this is probably the oldest board member they ever had, the longest serving board member that they had ever had. And I was on the board for the entire time. And it was fascinating during that time period because while I served in the board, I wasn't going in there and taking up space. The board went through a variety of different transformations, meaning there were times because the way the organization was set up, the board had to have a certain number of members. So sometimes the numbers were great, but then sometimes the numbers dropped to where it got really close to hitting that threshold. Because my understanding, if I remember correctly, and this has been a number of years, that part of the funding for the organization was contingent upon having a defined board of directors, and that required, having the board of directors having their own constitution and their bylaws, and the constitution and bylaws set forth the number of members that needed to be on the board. And whenever it got dangerously low, then of course members were encouraged to try to recruit other members. For whatever reason, I decided that if nothing else, I needed to stay on the board to make sure that that never dropped. And it was fascinating because during that time, dropping off never popped into my mind. Now, there's going to be some people who are going to say, "Well, Anthony Reeves, how many clients did you get out of that?" And I'm going to say, "None, actually." Because I had, there was a few times during the time I was there where they actually reached out to me. They said, "We have a member here that needs some legal help on a particular area. Do you think you can help them?" Sure. I ended up basically giving a lot of my legal services away. There was a couple of weird things that have popped up here and there where they were like, "I know this is not really what you're on as a board member. Would you mind just taking from a legal standpoint to determine whether or not this is something we need to get outside counsel for?" And I actually connected them with outside counsel on at least one or two occasions on things. So I was very proactive about from that standpoint. It was fascinating because I realized that going through this, I actually gave more of my time, especially my legal experiences, as opposed to earning cases from them. Because this is one of the attitude that I had. I knew the community that we were serving, and I felt like the only way I could be an effective board member was to become intimately familiar with the programs being administered by the organization, as well as getting a familiarity with the community that they were serving, as well as the other organizations that they were interacting with, and an appreciation of what that meant in terms of how they got their funding. So what does that mean? I'm saying a lot of gobbledygook. Well, a couple of things popped up. First of all, at the time, the organization was heavily reliant on grants. So as a result, they had funding from the city, county, state, and feds. And the executive director at the time was very proactive about looking for additional monies in any programs that were out there. And the thing that I was fascinating about my time there was during the transition, and we had a few, we kind of stabilized the second portion of the time I was there. The first 5 years was a little on the chaotic side, but probably the second 5 years, our board stabilized in terms of having a certain set of professionals who stayed on there for a significant period of time. I got I can't even call it a crash course. I got a thorough understanding of what it means to have organizations that are committed to providing services and what they have to do in order to make that happen. I mean, it was just fascinating because I learned about programs like Ryan White. I learned about housing opportunities for people with AIDS, or what's referred to as HOPWA. I understood what it means when different organizations are competing for the same pots of money. And that was the thing that was blowing my mind, because you'd see organizations similar to Miracle of Love basically going after the same amount of monies. And you start realizing when they were getting these monies, how these programs, the funds that were coming, were earmarked that you had to literally line item out how you're using this money in a particular way. And they were auditing you on a regular basis to make sure that you were not using that money in any way, shape, or form that was contrary to what they gave it to you for, or you risk losing that money. And I got a real education about what it means to have to rely on funding from all these different sources. And as a result, I got a great appreciation as to why unrestricted funds are so much more attractive, because if you're getting money from unrestricted, meaning money that you can use for whatever purpose, it's easy and more maneuverable to be able to put money to certain things that you like or need as you see fit based on the needs that you have. But when you're using money that literally says you can use 60% of this for this, 30% of this for this, 5% of this for this. You really have to line item things out very detailed so that you can ensure that you're addressing those things specifically, or you could get yourself in a lot of trouble. And it was amazing because while I was there, I also learned that over time, as the phenomena, you know, in terms of how the country or the community as a whole, or how the country's various, you know, agencies viewed the urgency with regards to the impact of HIV and AIDS and so forth, the money started going down, which made no sense to me. And I remember talking to these people who were doing this all the time, and they're like, "Well, the problem is that when AIDS first came into prominence in terms of people saying we got to jump on this thing, there was a lot of money being provided. But as time progressed and the level of measures of treatments became a lot more consistent in terms of being able to, you know, control the effects or control the side effects or control the impact of the impairment on individuals, then all of a sudden governments started shrinking the amount of money they were making available, which means now what's happening is less money is being given out by grants and more people are competing for those same dollars. And it was just mind-blowing to me because I was like, and I would ask all the time, but isn't there still a need? And they're like, yes, there's still a need. But the problem is that the people who are funding didn't view that need as being as significant as it was back when this was starting in like the 80s and like 70s and the 80s and the 90s and so forth like that. So I was getting a crash course, and I hate to say crash because crash implies that you did this over a short period of time. I was there almost 11 years. I just really was mind blown. And my philosophy all the time was that this was an ongoing learning process for me. So every time I went to a board meeting, and in the course of the board meeting, because like I said, we had a very unique dynamic and so forth of both professionals and users and individuals who were of different backgrounds as well as different gender, you know, different orientations, I would have wild conversations to educate me because I wanted to be educated because I didn't know. Like, for those of you like, what are you talking about? Great example. When I first went there back in 2006, I was practicing and there was the cocktail, meaning when individuals who found themselves being diagnosed with HIV in order to HIV positive, there was a cocktail of medications that they'd be given that usually, you know, depending on how you respond, imagine getting a boatload of pills in order to keep your immune system strong and prevent yourself from this thing, from yourself being infected and rising to the level to where you actually get the full-blown AIDS. But I know and there's going to be somebody who's going to correct me and say, you know, you said that all jacked up. I said, but you know what I'm saying, boo. Stay with me, bro. So what I'm saying is, at the time when I started this, that was the cocktail in 2006. I still operated under the assumption that the cocktail was still the prominent means by which persons who were HIV positive were still receiving treatment. By the time 2015, 16, I still remember the discussion I had with the board treasurer and our board president, who are, God bless them both, they're both still there. I remember them telling me, they were like, and they were talking about, you know, yeah, you know, part of the problem is that now with the medications that they have right now, they're, you know, you could take just a pill and the side effects of the medication is not as bad. And I stopped them. I said, wait a minute, the cocktail's not going on? And they looked at me, it's like, how have you been on the board for almost 10 years and you didn't know that? I'm like, we don't have these kind of conversations, man. And they were like, yeah, the medications have improved to the point to where the need for a cocktail, they've now gone from like 8-9 pills that you have to take to basically one. And the side effects of the medication aren't quite as devastating as they were back when you had to take the cocktail and the medication side effects would knock you on your backside. That was my experience. And in the course of those experiences, I also had the opportunity to go to different events. I remember going to different meetings that we used to have because they would do this running thing. Like once a year, they had a big staff meeting. They always encouraged the board members to come out. I think I went to like 4 or 5 of those, and they were always hilarious because, you know, the people who do, I'm always a firm believer that people who do nonprofit work, who truly are committed to serving, are a unique and valued and substantially significant and powerfully beautiful part of our community that we never thank enough. Because it takes a special kind of person to engage in a community of service above all else. It's easy to work for that paper and to get that and to go out there and get that money. I said, but these are people who are dedicated. They're invested in the communities that they're serving, and they're invested in ensuring that the individuals that they serve are truly that served. And I got a chance to watch all of that. I was with the organization when the organization grew. I was with the organization when the organization moved from their location in a building that was attached to a hospital to their own standalone building. I was there with the organization as they branched out to look at purchasing a building, as well as finding additional revenue sources that were unrestricted as opposed to grants and so forth. It was just a wild experience for me. And it's just interesting because, like I said, when I started with Miracle of Love, I was an associate with a law firm. I stayed with them during my time running my own law firm. I contributed to purchasing various shirts for them for different fundraising opportunities. So I had my law firm's name put on that. I provided legal counsel on a couple of issues where they were like, where they needed some assistance. I still remember when they were like, we need another board member, you know, Attorney Reeves, could you ask your wife if she'd be a member? And then it was funny, she became a member, and they were like, you think she might be mind being board chair? And I'm like, let me ask. And she did it. So it was fascinating. There was a period of time where literally she was the president, I was the board secretary, and it was wonderful. And I have to say that I truly, truly, truly don't know why I stayed for so long, other than the fact that it didn't feel like work. Now, don't get me wrong, board meetings used to drive me nuts because most of those board meetings were always, they were never short. Like, we would always have our meeting at like, our meetings were regularly at 5:30 or something like that. So 5:30, 6 o'clock, usually like 5:30. And we'd be walking out the door at like 7:30. I used to dread that. But I didn't dread the experience. You know, no one likes meetings and so forth, but I didn't tread the experience. And that experience lasted, and I know I've been saying this repeatedly during the course of this podcast. I did this for almost 11 years. And so recently, as I indicated, I had someone indicate, you know, what was your proud pride moment that you can remember? And I say, you know what? The one that I think resonates with me was the fact that I had the honor and pleasure of saying that I served on an organization that is still alive, still well, still doing great work for over a decade. And I can truly say with all degree and honesty that that was probably hands down the most influential and impactful, educational and inciting and insightful decade of my life, and I'm the all better for it. Thanks for tuning in, everyone. My name is Reeves. This is In the Know with Tony Reeves, and as always, thank you for tuning in, and most importantly, stay safe.